Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. And today we have two guests who have written a fantastic article that we're going to discuss with them. Capital Punishment by Nitrogen Gas, The Harsh Reality of Suffering and Injustice. So we have Dr. Peter Papadakis, who's a professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine, surgery, neurology and neurosurgery, and is director of critical care medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center, New York. He's also a professor of internal medicine at the Mercy University School of Medicine in Macon, Georgia. And we have Dr. Robert Glatter, who is the assistant professor of emergency medicine in the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell Hospital in Hempstead, New York. So just before we get going to discuss your article, I just wanted to do a shout out to the Death Penalty Information Center, which documents essential statistics such as execution numbers, death row population, and the methods of execution. Capital punishment is still legal in 27 states in the US, and there is no death penalty in 23 states. However, four states also have a hold on executions, and those are California, Pennsylvania, Oregon, and Ohio. If we're looking at global trends, 80% of executions globally take place in five countries: China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the US. So, Dr. Glatter and Dr. Papadakis, you wrote a very interesting and poignant piece about the execution of Kenneth Smith in Alabama in January 2024, and he was the first prisoner to be executed using nitrogen gas. So many of our listeners are not clinicians, so can you tell us what nitrogen is and what it is supposed to do?
Peter, I'll let you begin, since as an anesthesiologist, you have the...
Well, nitrogen makes up close to 78 to 79% of the gas of our atmosphere on the planet Earth. 21% obviously is oxygen. Nitrogen is an inert gas. We breathe it in totally, but again, our lives are dependent on the oxygen and the oxygen concentration. There's a lot of data, scientific data, about as we get to higher altitudes, how oxygen concentrations fall off. That's why people use oxygen at higher altitudes, pressurized cabins on modern airplanes. But if you watched films about World War II, you know, it was an oxygen mask. People have measured the concentration of oxygen at Mount Everest, very low concentrations. So there's a lot of literature out there that has been published on what low concentration oxygen does to the body, how it affects the body. The other thing is we have a very robust literature about patients who have the inability to metabolize the oxygen that we have in our atmosphere because of COPD, emphysema, status asthmaticus, adult respiratory distress syndrome. So under the clinical setting, we have been observing patients for many decades, both in the emergency room that my colleague, Dr. Glatter, who meets these patients acutely who have oxygen hunger, and I in the ICU who are managing the critically ill, and know that oxygen hunger, hypoxemia, so to speak, is not good. So the development of this form of execution meets what I call my criterion of inhumane, because by definition, hypoxemia is suffering and a terrible way to die.
Yeah, I'll concur with that, Peter, in every way. Look, air hunger is something that I witness and see every day in my practice. And specifically during COVID, we had patients come in, you know, with PO2s that you're referencing that on Mount Everest were in the 9 range, maybe single digits, teens. that actually survived neurologically intact, but, you know, certainly those are people who were not compromised and didn't have lots of comorbidities. But ultimately, you know, forced nitrogen hypoxia is really a substitute, in my opinion, for really, you know, we're talking about an injection protocol that often is used and is used traditionally now as the main form of execution in the United States and has been upheld as of 2008 by the Supreme Court. Traditionally, in an injection type protocol, in order to execute a prisoner, there's three drugs involved. Peter, you know this well. There's first a sedative given, and typically in the past it was sodium thiopental. This was first used in 1977 in Oklahoma as the first case. And then followed by that, that's basically to make the patient unresponsive so they don't feel any pain. Now, the second drug given typically is a paralytic. Pancuronium or Pavulon has traditionally been that drug. Sometimes it's substituted with another paralytic, depending on what's available in correctional facilities. But then the third drug, potassium chloride, is what stops the heart and depolarizes the heart. This traditional three-drug protocol has been what's used really since, I would say, the early 2000s. And every state now has more or less gone to this as the de facto way, unless there's some reason not to. Other methods, including the firing squad, and certainly, you know, other types of modalities or methods, I should call, that are barbaric, electrocution, including one of them, you know, are still practiced in several states, and it's problematic. The cruel and inhumane treatment of prisoners that are being put to death, and in some cases without DNA evidence, which we'll talk about later, is significantly problematic. And there are many patients on death row for decades without DNA evidence to, you know, certainly have definitive proof of their crime and their involvement in the crime. So I think that this discussion goes toward, in my opinion, the cruel and inhumane treatment of patients that continues to go on and that our courts certainly are not stopping. Until we get an amendment to the Constitution or the court to revisit a case, I don't think this is going to stop. And Peter, are you in any way feeling that this has any momentum with the Death Penalty Information Center and other you know, types of organizations?
Well, one thing that may spur this, and I think there is going to be a legal challenge to the topic that we have at hand at nitrogen, because the UN, which we are a signatory of and a member of the Security Council, states that nitrogen gas execution is against international law. There's no such ruling for the other forms of execution, which I find very interesting. But the UN did make a point of saying that this is against international law. And I think it probably dates back to the founding of the United Nations, where gas execution was used by the Nazis during the Holocaust. And it was had such a horrendous outcome that I think during the early 1950s, late 1940s, they mentioned gas execution and nitrogen execution because of the horrific events of the Holocaust.
And I think that the reference to that really provides the setting on international norms that we really need to follow such norms. We call ourselves a civilized nation, we wrote in our piece. You know, are we civilized? That's really the question. If we're still continuing to perform capital punishment in any way, shape, or form, I think we have to revisit this. You know, we need to take a good look at the ethics behind what we're doing. And again, this goes back to having the proof of, you know, definitive proof by DNA. And many of these people still on death row are not having the correct evidence that provides definitive proof of a crime. So I think, you know, on many levels, we have to get it right, and we haven't gotten it right. Look, forced nitrogen hypoxia is a painful, horrendous death. The witnesses to Kenneth Smith's execution, as we write, witnessed this. Reporters provided clear accounts of gasping, heaving, retching. This is certainly not a painful type process. Now, the theory that we write is that as carbon dioxide levels rise, you lose consciousness. So that the idea that you provide pure nitrogen that you won't in any way, shape, or form feel is not correct medically, okay? So this premise is a fallacy, as we write. And Peter, I think you can expand upon this a little bit greater.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Bob. I have been doing research on ARDS and hypoxemia for 35 years. I've written a textbook on lung physiology. We know, what Bob just said, the myth of high CO2 levels being an anesthetic is disproved by the length of how long these executions take. The reports from Alabama and several other reports, 20 to 30 minutes is not a short period of time, okay? Low levels of oxygen don't make you, we have a lot of data from high elevations and clinical reports of people with very, very low oxygen concentrations who have survived after being resuscitated and have memories of being in the intensive care unit. So there is a level of consciousness that somebody under nitrogen execution will have, a prolonged period of understanding death is occurring, which I find horrendous. You know you're dying and you're gasping for oxygen. And the other thing, high levels of CO2, there's people walking around in your community that have COPD and they're walking around with CO2 levels that are 3 to 4 times your normal level, and they're driving taxis and working in restaurants with their nasal oxygen on. So they have very high CO2 levels. They're not sleepy. They're reading, they're watching TV. The average COPD patient staring at their television on home oxygen may have a level that's twice your level. And they're obviously cognizant of what's on television, reading, interacting with their family. One point that I want to bring up, which I think is a very important point, is this whole form of execution was adopted. The nitrogen execution was adopted by the three states that have adopted it because of a history of botched intravenous executions. And they took it upon themselves to start doing this with a lot of mythology and not scientific data, because there is no large, robust scientific data of people who studied nitrogen hypoxemia in terms of, we have these offhand reports of people using nitrogen to commit suicide. There was a large spike in that using nitrogen for suicide because of some kind of data from mistakes in putting oxygen in scuba divers tanks or airplane oxygen tanks, whatever. But, that's not scientific. We don't know the other circumstances. And one of the interesting factors that I've in researching our article was the amount of people using nitrogen for suicide has actually gone down because it's gotten into that suicide community that it is not a good way to die, okay? So why a state without medical guidance would start on this pathway is amazing to me, and also abhorrent that we've done this.
And to add to your point, the Attorney General has, come out to say that this is now a proven method of execution that works, in a statement that he made after Kenneth Smith's execution. So yeah, for him to make that statement, is clearly such an inflammatory comment and flies in the face of all medical literature that you just really describe. So I think that, you know, look, the reality is the legal community has to understand the medical community. There has to be some type of common ground where certainly the Supreme Court at some point can hear a case, a challenge, one of these nitrogen hypoxia cases that will make it there, that will really hopefully turn things in a way that we can, you know, shift the balance of power away and convince these justices that this is not a humane way, first of all, and we shouldn't be practicing capital punishment in any sense. So, you know, I just feel that hopefully the momentum will change and we'll get a challenge that the court will hear.
You know, if I can reinforce what you said, an attorney general that is, I apologize for using the term, bragging about this form of execution, I think any lay person would understand, here's the base statement. It took us 30 minutes to kill somebody.
Right. It should, you know, this should take really, you know, under a minute, maybe.
You know, to talk about humanity, that is not humane.
Right. The idea that someone is going to feel air hunger, it's the idea of suffocation. Each of us has seen patients, and I've seen my fair share over my career of patients with acute hypoxia, struggling to breathe, trying to tripod, put their hands up, you know, cyanotic, turning blue, just struggling and gasping. And to witness this, you know, is just horrific, you know, and then to rescue them is certainly what we do. We save lives. We're committed to the preservation of life. And that's what we do.
I think it's really valuable to have the medical perspective on this. It's a very strong voice. Can I just go back, though, to one of your points about botched executions and the fact that this has been considered an acceptable method in these states? It seems like the states that are using this are now growing. We've got Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, all using nitrogen for executions. So have botched executions been a problem for a long, long time? Or is this related to some of the shortages of drugs, the injectable forms?
You know, I think I'll take this. I think our story points to something very important. The person that was executed in Alabama using nitrogen gas, they attempted to execute using lethal injection previously, and it was botched. So, you know, the term botched means it was unsuccessful. They didn't kill him. He had excruciating pain. The IV, I would presume, infiltrated. As Bob has stated, thiopental hurts when you give it as an injection if it's not in a good vein. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the points that Bob's going to bring up is the people involved in the execution are not medically trained individuals. And we can elaborate on that after Bob.
Yeah. And thanks, Peter. I mean, the people who are doing these executions in state correctional facilities, federal correctional facilities, are certainly not physicians that we know of. I mean, it's against the Hippocratic Oath. The AMA clearly has a statement against this. And it's unclear. These correctional officers were presumably who are doing these types of executions. They may be paramedics, possibly. They may also, you know, be EMTs and have some ability to place an IV catheter. We don't know, but of the botched executions that we're seeing, typically it's because the IV placement is incorrect. It infiltrates. It goes into the subcutaneous tissue in the skin. And certainly they don't receive the medication. And therefore, that's why the patient suffers, okay? Or prisoner, rather. And so, you know, we don't have proper staff performing these executions, which goes to the reason why they're botched in many cases. And, you know, Amelia, you were asking, how often are they botched? I don't have exact numbers, but I can tell you that, you know, in certain states, the percentage is exceedingly high. We hear about this in news reports, and it's because the staff doing this has no formal training. They may watch a video, they may, you know, who knows what they're doing, but they don't have any training. And this goes to the point why these executions are generally unsuccessful.
Another important point is, since the American Medical Association does not support this and says this is not the practice of medicine, the American Board of Anesthesia, which you would think somebody to do skilled sedation should be an anesthesiologist or someone with special training like a nurse anesthetist, both those groups are not involved in this, because the American Board of Anesthesia has a strong statement that if an anesthesiologist or a nurse anesthetist by their society participates in this, they will lose their certification. Our sister organization, the American Society of Anesthesiology, totally agrees with the AMA and again says that this is not the practice of medicine. So what I'm going to go back to is some nursing organizations also have stated that this is not ethical nursing care. So it goes back to Bob's point, who's giving the injection? So if it is prison personnel with no legal authority within their own state to administer these drugs, you get into a legal debate that the state is telling people to do something that's illegal, because you know, a paramedic is not allowed to push thiopental or potassium or a neuromuscular blocker. So the state is actually, in most states, violating their own state standards as to the practice of medicine.
Yeah, and to your point, sorry to interrupt, but this is taxpayer-funded money that's going towards this. So if you want to really get to the heart of this, that the American public is funding this illegal practice that you're referring to, which, you know, I think if you have a legal challenge, would potentially constitute grounds for elevating, you know, cases to the level possibly of the Supreme Court, because you've got a state issue, which then has to be adjudicated or litigated to a higher type of court. And again, I'm not certainly, I do not have a legal background and I can't speak to this, but from an ethical standpoint and a jurisprudence standpoint, I would certainly have, you know, the Death Penalty Information Center approach it from that angle. And I'm curious, Elizabeth or Amelia, if that has been, in your opinion or knowledge, been done.
That I'm not sure about. I'm not an expert on this topic, but I really appreciate you bringing this medical lens to this. You've said that it's, you know, these organizations, you know, the ABA and things like that are banning their members, obviously, from taking part or being associated with any of these executions. Do you think that medical organizations should be taking a stronger stand? Because obviously lawyers can go and litigate things and, you know, there's policy things that potentially could happen. But I mean, should medical people be standing up more against these practices? I mean, personally, I'm against the death penalty, no matter what, whether someone's guilty, not guilty, whatever evidence is there. I'm completely against the death penalty. I think it's completely barbaric. And, you know, should medical institutions and organizations be taking a stronger stand?
Look, I think that the AMA and every major professional society has already come out, but could we use a stronger statement? Absolutely. There's no question. Now, after this forced nitrogen hypoxia execution, there was an editorial in JAMA put out by Drs. Bickler and Lipnick and from UCSF Hypoxia Laboratory that clearly made, you know, it rung true. It really talked about the scientific and medical evidence that supports banning the use of such a procedure, period. No questions asked. Now, subsequent to that, I did not see a statement, maybe Peter, you have, from the AMA or any larger organization beyond that, collectively supporting that editorial. Maybe you want to opine on that.
The ASA and the ABA both added their voice that this is inhumane, and it's on their website. And I think what needs to happen is next time this sort of thing goes up to the Supreme Court, medical societies should be on the side of the litigants as adding their voice to it. And as we pointed out, nitrogen specifically is against international law. So, you know, I don't understand how these attorney generals or whoever comes up with these ideas in these states moves forward on these things. What is their basis other than believing that a death sentence is some sort of deterrent to crime, right? I think the victim is not served. As Bob pointed out, people being on death row for 40 years awaiting execution is not helping the victims' families. I think it's probably
expensive as well.
You know, at some point in time, the murderer will be killed. We can't tell you when it's going to happen. It is not an appropriate thing for a civilized society to do, because it also is a burden on the victims and the victims' families, you know, the way you see it, you look at it.
Yeah, the irreparable harm emotionally to an innocent person who sits on death row for 30 years with, a conviction that goes unchallenged and that awaits, execution is just horrendous. And that in and of itself is so detrimental to what we call a civilized society. We can't have this go on. We can't have people sitting on death row for decades. There have to be challenges to such practices that continue to go on. And I think that Congress needs to step up and hold hearings. There has to be a congressional response, not just a state level. I know this is in the realm of the states, but I think that there has to be greater action, call to action from the AMA, from all medical societies, and a letter to key stakeholders in Congress to approach this from a humane, and again, if we're going to call ourselves a civilized society, we have to end any type of execution, whether it be electrocution, firing squad, whether it be forced nitrogen hypoxia, which is abhorrent, which we've clearly agreed upon. It just doesn't make any sense that in 2025, that we are killing individuals in any shape or form. And many of these, prisoners are innocent and don't have DNA evidence. And again, we have to, keep raising our voice, keep trying to make changes. And I think that's the best we can do. But obviously to date, it hasn't been enough. So I think we really have to have a challenge case to the court. And that really is the crux of things.
Well, I think, Bob, you bring up a very important point. On almost a monthly basis, there are articles in the news media about someone who was convicted of murder, be it in a state with capital punishment or a state without capital punishment, who several years later is found innocent because a new witness comes up, or they catch the real killer who admits to murdering somebody 10 years in the past. People of means can hire very good lawyers, but unfortunately the vast majority of people who get convicted to these capital offenses are people that are using the public defender to, they due to their financial means and cultural means, they don't have the benefit of hiring top legal counsel. So that also is a variable in terms of how we punish people. The wealthy, may be able to manipulate the court system, and the disadvantaged may not. And again, going back to how many times have we heard of someone who has been mistakenly convicted of murder, who is set free, and then is suing the state for millions of dollars of, lost income, time with their families, what have you. The legal system is not perfect. I think that's a good summary statement. It has many flaws, and killing somebody within the legal system by capital punishment just reinforces one era does not correct the second era.
Right. Yeah. And look, the governors of these states, look, it starts with, you know, voting. And I'll focus on that because who you elect to office, you know, in any state really holds the power and the keys to making change. And I think especially in southern states, this is what we're witnessing, that these governors have a hard line toward capital punishment. And, you know, if people are to make change and affect change, they have to vote. Simple as that, period. No questions asked. It's who we elect that influence how our policies are enforced. And I think we have to make these basic changes in order to change our society and how our norms are conducted and how our policies are put into place.
Absolutely. And I just want to chime in here. It's a great dialogue. Both of you should actually have your own podcast because I usually ask questions, but I'm so intrigued and engaged with both of your dialogues about this really important topic. And again, thank you so much for coming. I do want to at least ask one question to you. And you did mention about death penalties, really not lowering or deterring crime rates or violent crimes. I am curious about the delayed executions. You know, usually, as you mentioned, both of you mentioned, for decades, we have individuals on death row and they have a particular date. And then all of a sudden, that date is changed and kicked down the road to another 6 months. And then again, something happens and then it is kicked down another 6 months and it continues for quite some time. And I'm pretty sure there's a psychological weight on that individual that, you know, oh, I'm going to die today. And then, oh no, you're going to be alive another 6 months, right? So are delayed executions, do you think, are they ethical in any? I know that executions in general, you clearly state that they're unethical. But to add insult to injury, are delayed executions where a particular date is continued to be kicked down the road ethical in your opinion? And now that we have all of these DNA technologies that are available, should all of these particular cases that were not really crystallized or cases that were really sketchy from the beginning, not really a lot of evidence, but still individuals were deemed guilty. Should those cases, in your opinion, be reviewed and possibly if it's tangible to have DNA technologies involved to really see if that individual or individuals are actually innocent or like so many other particular cases previously, the cases were overturned because the DNA evidence clearly says that this individual or individuals were not the responsible party for this, you know, violent or horrific crime. No, that was a long question, but yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
If I may answer the first part, being told you're going to die tomorrow or 2 hours from now, and then, oh, by the way, we're not going to kill you later, is actually by definition psychologically very stressful, psychologically very damaging, but also banned by the Geneva Convention because they that was an early form of torture. They would threaten you with execution or death as part of the interrogation, right? So being in a prolonged, stressful state, I think, affects hormones, catecholamines, makes your body sick. You know, prolonged stress is not good. And I think it is a horrendous form of torture, you know. Even in the news now, several of the hostages from Gaza stated that that was a technique that was used by the people that were holding them. It's a very common torture technique to be threatening death and then withdrawing death in the last moment.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Peter. It flies in the face of the Geneva Convention and obviously in Gaza. And this is just abhorrent, simply put. Yeah, you know, the idea of saying that you're going to die today and no, you're not going to die is, as you said, it's psychological torture. And it's just, exquisitely painful. There should be limits set, I think, in my opinion, on, you know, how long you can sit on death row, and then that should be simply the end of it. If they can't, you know, come up with evidence either to corroborate the crime, prove it or disprove the crime, you know, either way, that's up for debate. But I think that, you know, we're always trying to save a life if we can. If evidence arises that, you know, proves or disproves the crime, that's what we're waiting for. But to have someone wait 40 years on death row or 30 years needs to be reexamined. I can't say definitively what that time limit should be, but there has to be a limit put on it. And we can't have this practice go on and on. Simply put, you know, evidence and people always come forward at really just unclear and inopportune or opportune times. And it's unpredictable. But I think that limits in some ways could, you know, could be a positive or a negative. And again, that's up for debate. But again, the Geneva Convention clearly states that, you know, psychologically torturing someone by saying you're going to die and then you're not going to die, we can all agree that is against international norms and violates how we should treat people in any humane way.
You know, I think the way to end this torture of being on death row is that there is no death row. Capital punishment should not be a legal option. And I think many parts of the world do not have death sentences for even the most horrendous crimes. You know, just being separated from society is punishment, and not being able to lead a normal life. So the people who are very conservative and say, well, we have to punish people, well, someone being in jail for the rest of their lives is a better option than a death penalty that many times is flawed. And as Bob's pointed out, you know, DNA evidence comes up or somebody else confesses to the crime years later and that person's already been executed.
Right. And that's happened, as we know. And what do you tell the family? How do you even, you know, face a family that now has evidence? There's clear DNA evidence. And someone certainly comes forward to expunge or to clear a name. It's just indescribable and just painful beyond, you know, in any way, shape, or form.
Now, I'm curious. So, to your knowledge, has there been any type of advocacy for individuals who are still on death row and they feel that the way that they were convicted obviously wasn't ethical, it wasn't a significant amount of evidence, and they're still alive, they're still in the prison system. Are there pushes that for those type of cases, that all of those cases, I know there have been a selected few, but for all of those cases to be automatically reviewed using DNA technology? I do not know, is that a current thing, or do you feel that that should be something, at least as in an ethical lens and a legal lens, as you mentioned, regarding the Geneva Convention, do you feel that that is something that ought to be done? I don't know. That's not really my area. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, from what my knowledge is that, you know, this is determined state by state. And again, the criteria for, you know, review are determined at that level. So certainly there's no federal statute that exists that I'm aware of on the books. Peter, I don't know if you're aware of anything, but there's nothing that certainly describes in any clear statement that, to your point, Kirk, of what you're asking. And it would be interesting to offer this up to certainly a legal scholar, a constitutional scholar, to see if there's anything as a movement towards that realm. Because I think it should be done. There's no question. Absolutely. To have this mandated review of evidence occur for any inmate, you know, every year, you know, at any defined period of time, remain on death row. And I think that's only fair. And that is humane treatment, to give them a fair opportunity to clear their name, if that's the case.
And remember, the death row prisoner who has a private attorney and financial means may reach out to a private laboratory or has the ability to push for DNA evidence or further investigation, hire private investigators. The average death row patient does not have those financial means or the influence to get those resources. And I agree with Bob, these resources should be used. It is 2025. DNA analysis is not that challenging, right? We can test our own ancestry for a fee.
Right.
So it is not like some highly complex thing that it was 20, 30 years ago.
Right. And the cost of doing this, of doing DNA analysis and even small interfering RNA analysis, which is coming more toward the forefront now, and looking at genomes, is relatively inexpensive compared to when the technology first emerged. So my point, and I guess would be that the cost of the technology should be worked into state budgets so that prisoners can have the opportunity to have evidence, if it's available, you know, tested by these means. And it should be equality and justice for all, just as we say in this country. We have to practice what we preach. And I think that really is something, you know, again, our norms of our society have to be representative of our society. How can we as a nation call ourselves civilized? And it goes back to the same point. I agree with Peter, we have to outlaw capital punishment. We cannot stop until this occurs.
Well, I also just want to follow up on a couple of things. This has been a fabulous discussion. I want to put a shout out for the Equal Justice Initiative with Brian Stevenson, because he's advocated a lot for minorities who are within the justice system. And as you have both mentioned, tend to not be able to get good legal counsel and therefore, you know, disproportionately potentially suffering and experiencing executions because they have poor legal representation. But I also think I just want to also thank you so much for your article, because I think we don't hear enough about this in the media. We tend to hear about things going wrong, but it was a very poignant piece that you wrote. And while we all disagree with executions, that's probably a long way off before we can solve that problem. But certainly bringing attention to this particularly cruel mechanism for executing people is really important.
Yeah, and we really appreciate it, Amelia.
Greatly appreciated. And I think something we could reinforce is when the general public reads about one of these executions, they are not told that there was no physician participating in that execution. They just think that there was a doctor there, which again clouds our profession, but again, is not a true statement. There was no doctor there. There wasn't an anesthesiologist administering either the nitrogen or the lethal injection.
Right. And I think one point wasn't raised is that where you live influences your chances of survival. You know, whether you, any given state, it determines whether you live or die if you are convicted of a crime, say you didn't commit. And that in and of itself, you know, is problematic. And I think we need, you know, obviously to look at that point, that your geography determines your chances of life or death, simply put, period.
It's definitely a very unfair system. Well, thank you both so much for being here today. It's been a fabulous discussion. And
thank you again for the opportunity. Yeah,
please let us know if you're writing any more about this.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chun. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.